everyone! Welcome to 8-Bit Geeks 8-Bit Horror Fest, Space Madness, or whatever the fuck they're calling it. I'm Bill!
I'm Steve!
And this is Movie Films of Bill and Steve, and this week we're looking at Galaxy of Terror, 1981, rated R, 1 hour, 21 minutes, directed by Bruce D. Clark. Science fiction suspense thriller in which a rescue spaceship crew meets up with horrors projected by their own imaginations.
Okay.
Quite the spoiler for the end of the film and that synopsis.
quite the fucking spoiler. Holy shit. That's the entire twist of the film.
That is. And it's a classic example of 80s democratic VHS market landscape of a poster that is nothing like the movie.
Nothing.
Which is sad, because I think this movie lends itself to a lot of good visuals that could have been really cool on a poster. I think this poster undersells the movie.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Makes me think I'm expecting some Harryhausen, like, BS, like, 60s garbage or something. You know, this film is sleek and beautiful, because we got good old Jimmy Cameron as our production designer.
Oh, I didn't realize. You're totally right.
Yeah, this part, big reason I wanted to watch this film, because I knew James Cameron is a production designer on it. This is back when he was working for Roger Corman before he really broke out doing his own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a Roger Corman, this is a New World Picture release. So, you know, you can, if you're listening to this and you're from 8-Bit Geek, you probably don't know what the fuck that means. if you might, so you kind of know what kind of film we're looking into get here. But I'll say from the get-go that I think this is definitely a step up from a lot of other Roger Corman's fare.
Yeah,
I'd say
that's fair.
From the 70s and this time period. So we'll just do our classic movie film style review. Steve, what did you think of Galaxy of Terror?
This was a weird film to digest, where I kept feeling like I was watching it, and yet I was missing large parts of the film.
Yeah.
It was interesting. This clearly was like, okay, Alien did well, so let's make another sci-fi horror-based film. Mm-hmm. And then there's, like, weird stuff where, like, in the opening, I felt that, like, there was a bunch of fucking, like, information being dumped on you about this fucking planet and the Master and the fact that he plays games with this chick and, like, all this information that doesn't come up again until, like...
Dimitri, the Oracle of Space?
Clearly. like it seems so irrelevant because most of the rest of the movie they just refer to like, yeah, the Master sent us on this mission, and I'm just like, I didn't need this backstory to just understand their boss sent them on this mission. And then finally in the very end of the film, the Master at least becomes important again, but at the same time all that other info dump was just like, what the fuck is this? Why are you setting up this weird ass fantasy space opera level backstory information for this very simplistic horror story that just so happens to be on another planet?
Well, it's that mix of Star Wars is still really popular in this time period, because obviously this would have been production in probably 1980, late 80s, so you're still off the heels of Empire and all that other stuff. We're getting into the time period of Return of the Jedi coming out. Obviously there's a lot of that. It's one thing, it's not so, it's like you're getting a bunch of information in the first 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
but it's not really explained to you. You're just dumped into this. So kind of in a Star Wars sense, but in that, it's simple enough where you can digest it. This is just madness until the ship launches and they're in space, and then it becomes a film that you can relate to and understand.
Yeah.
Like, I think maybe about 45 minutes in the film, I was sitting here wondering, wishing I had somebody just to look it in the camera and give me some exposition. Because I would love to have some understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, because, like, I'll talk shit on, like, the overall plot of the film, but I want to say, like, just to be quick right now before we complain further, before people get the wrong idea, I actually fucking love the characters in this movie.
Yeah.
I think everyone is, like, super nice and relatable, and there's a lot of really human moments with all these fucking characters. And that's what kept me signed on to the film, because that's what kept the film grounded. With all this fucking insanity and lack of exposition, I kept on saying, well, at least I like blank and blank.
And I do want to defend real quick, because my initial note said I wish I had some exposition. It made sense in the overall scope of the film, because the characters themselves... Sorry, I should back up. I only wanted to know what they were doing. All I know is they're being sent to Remus, trying to find some ship. I'm gathering that on my own, But I feel like I was just not understanding why they were there.
Yeah.
Beyond they were sent here. I didn't understand it was a rescue mission. Like, there's no moment where, like, there's no briefing where it's like, this ship disappeared, we have to go find them. All we see is the beginning of the film, something terrible happened to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then these people are being launched. We don't know if they're going to rescue there. They don't know if they're trying to search for cargo. We don't know who they were, if they're important or not, what organization is running this, why are they here? That's the only stuff I feel like I needed. I guess ultimately in this
I just assumed that the company was sending Burke to get some aliens.
I assume so, because, like, obviously we're going into this with some baggage from Aliens, thinking that what kind of film this is, even though this film came out before Aliens. And I'm also waiting for, again, like, same stuff from Alien, where there's a double,
a screw job, yeah.
Yeah, screw job, which there kind of is, but I was expecting what, like, Core to be the robot trying to get this alien that's causing all this stuff, until we find out all the stuff with him, which as we kind of progress through the plot, we'll talk more about what his role was. And so I was expecting that kind of stuff, and it went in a completely different direction. This is the weirdest, like, Doctor Who prequel film I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seriously. They would totally make sense for the Doctor to just land in this situation and be like, oh, fuck, it's the Master. I got this.
And this is how the Master doesn't regenerate. He just picks new pupils.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the TV movie. He's just jumping from body to body.
Yeah. It's the lack of knowledge, going back to that, is, like, fine, because that's the characters have a lack of knowledge. I just needed the knowledge of why they're there. It's okay, I'm down to be on the ride with them, not knowing what the fuck is going on and why people are dying and this shit going bananas all the time for these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because eventually it's a mystery that is resolved in the end. And I'm down for that. It's just the little bits establishing why they're doing this. That's why I felt really lost in regards to that. But there comes a point at the halfway point where it's like, that doesn't matter anymore, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Because you're just seeing, like, just ludicrous fucking shit happen to these people in a very, like, an Event Horizon situation.
Yeah, for sure.
Where they're essentially going to hell.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, I thought that's what... I'm just sitting here thinking, like, where is this going? Like, they're doing this hyper jump, and all of a sudden it's going bananas crazy. I'm like, oh, is this going to be like an Event Horizon situation where they're bringing, like, demons on board or something? Because I read the synopsis, so I'm thinking, like, where is the turn here? What's going to happen here?
Yeah.
And I fully admit, I didn't... I think a point... I kind of expected something was up with Core, but I wasn't expecting Core to be the Master.
Yeah.
And then, like, all the stuff that he was doing to these people.
Yeah, this being a weird recruiting game definitely was not what I was expecting.
No, for sure. So I guess more about the events happening to these characters. But yeah, let's go back to the characters. So we got Cabron, Aluma, Kor, Demela, Commander Livar, or Ivar, Balon, Ranger, Kuhad, and Captain Trantor.
Okay.
These are a bunch of people.
Yes.
Two most recognizable faces in this film for me were Sid Haig and Robert Englund.
I agree.
I gotta say, right off the bat, I was really kind of happy that Robert Englund actually, like, survived the entire film.
I know, right? Like, I mean, if this was a game to get the new Master, shouldn't he be half Master?
No, because he failed at times. I guess, I don't know. It's very clear by the end they must have forgot about him.
Yeah.
He wasn't that important.
Yeah, he doesn't come back again. But yeah, I dug that he survived. I liked his character a lot.
Yeah, the entire time I just kept going, oh, when Ranger is fighting his duplicate and being succumbed to stuff, I'm like, oh, that sucks. Robert Englund's going to die. But no, he kept surviving. He's, like, one of the last people alive. I was like, I was really happy about that.
It was also cool to see kind of like some Freddy in his double.
Yeah, you can see a lot of early elements there.
Yeah, early elements. But it worked out, and I like that scene too, where he's just like, he's fighting it. I like the fact that, like, he shoots it, it does nothing, but hitting it in the gut is enough to knock the double back. That's in a lot of movies, and I always laugh at that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna walk into your blast, but oh man, your foot? Fuck.
That's a powerful foot.
It took the wind out of me.
Well, have you been shot by a laser cannon?
No, you're right.
But have you been kicked by a foot?
One of the earliest scenes that really, speaking of England, one of the earliest scenes that really sold me on these characters with how realistic it was when everyone is flipping their shit over the fact that the captain is taking off in 30 seconds and no one's ready. England can't get, like, the chair open. So, like, one of the other crew members just says, fuck it, sit in my lap and I'll wrap my legs around you.
Yeah.
And it's, like, such a human fucking moment in, like, what seems to so far be a weird-ass fucking movie that I was just like, okay, let's do this. I like that a lot. It's so simple, but it really won me over for, like, the rest of the film.
Yeah, I enjoyed the characters in this film totally. I was down for all of them. I think they have great motivations. Baylon is a total fucking prick.
Yeah.
His entire fucking movie. It's so much so that I wasn't sure if he was supposed to be our lead or not. Mm-hmm. Like earlier in the film, like between Cabrin and Baylon, I was unsure. I was very confused a lot of times who I was supposed to be considering to be the lead here.
Yeah, I also wasn't sure either because one of the reasons why is it pronounced Cabrin?
I thought it was. I wrote down Cameron. I kept sounding that way, but written it's C A B R E N.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, whatever that guy, Cabby, yeah. Old Cabby.
There we go.
He was, like, really nice, and I really like that, because you don't usually get that with these sorts of characters in these sorts of movies. Like, when the other guy was, like, freaking out, he wasn't like, oh, come on, pussy, step it up. You ever get mistaken for a man, Vasquez? He walked over and was just like, hey, it'll be okay. The first time's always hard, but it gets easier.
Yeah.
And I just really like that. I just really like that. And the commander, too, holy shit! This is, like, the greatest commander I've seen in any of these fucking movies. He is so human, he is so real, he is talking shit on the captain for being insane, he's checking in on people to make sure that they're okay, he is struggling to, like, climb this mountain, and instead of trying to be like, yep, I'm a badass, he's just like, I'm getting too old for this shit, I should not be on this mission, you're not old, now when I look at you, sweet thing, so fucking smooth, mm-hmm. And then he's the motherfucker that's just like, no, I'm gonna go in this pit first. You know, yeah. You don't have to do that. You're the commander. We're all on board. Like, no, fuck you guys. I'm an old man. I'm going in first in case there's any problems. Like, holy shit. What a great character to be that sort of character.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I don't mean this as a slight, but a lot of Roger Corman's films are pretty trash. There's normally, because he's there to make a buck.
Yeah.
Most of the time. But this is definitely a case where... this script has really good characters. This film, and it's and I will say, like, again, going back to what I said earlier, this film doesn't feel like a Roger Corman fare, because it actually, I don't know if it's just, I can blame this solely on James Cameron, but it has really good production quality. This feels like a real film.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that's just kind of thrown together and tossed out there. It looks really good.
Yeah. For a 1981 film, for anyone that's not as familiar as we are with, like, older movies.
Well, yeah, especially with its $1.8 million budget. Like, every dollar is on the screen.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
This film is actually taking other larger studio films from the time to task with just how good it looks. Like, this when we talk about James Cameron on our podcast, and maybe other people bring this up, and we kind of talk about where he's gone now, like the Avatar films and how bloated the budgets are and how unnecessary, like, all the CG and everything is. I long for days like this, Terminator 2, even though it's a big film, but, like, you see everything on the screen.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a tactility to it, like, everything feels real.
Yeah.
Even with, like, I think this film has gorgeous matte shots, gorgeous miniature work.
Oh, it fucking does, for sure.
Even the composite shots, I think, are very solid for a film of this low budget and how in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really impressed with how much they were able to do with so little, and also with the actor performances. Everyone in here, I think, is giving a very good performance.
Mm-hmm.
Even little things. I mean, with Grace Zabriskie, who's playing the Captain Trantor, just all the small stuff. It first is kind of jarring when they first do her, like, moment of PSD when talking about. Hespress. Like the thing that she survived, her PTSD moment she keeps having, which again feeds on her fear and ultimately her death and her sequence. Like those little things there. I mean, you talk again about.
And I think it's interesting that they don't specifically get into like what she went through. Like, yeah, she sort of get the feeling that whatever they're walking into is exactly what she dealt with. But by the end of the film, you know that's impossible. Like, she didn't do some other fucking game to get a new master. She dealt with something else, and you never really get a clear answer of what that was. And I like that.
Yeah, that's the type of stuff where I like that small elements of world building. That I can get into that, but it's just when you have like an old, again, Mitri, the Oracle of Space, and Red Face Master, and you're just throwing way too much at me at once.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I get confused and I can't relate to this. But you talk about a battle, and then you show her face get like wide eyed and like have like a weird like soundtrack score bit with it, and you can show that was some serious shit, and it really fucked her up long term.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot about that character from that. And again, you go back to the cool moments of Qabrin played by Edward Albert. Man, he's so fucking smooth and like so nice and likable. But at the same time, Baylon has such animosity towards him. I'm just like, oh, so is Qabrin a bad guy, or what's going on with this guy? He seems really cool.
And no, he's really cool.
Yeah, and then Baylon's the unit leader kind of, and he's always doing stuff. So I'm not sure. The synopses on like Wikipedia and stuff say like Qabrin is the main character, but like in the film, he almost feels like the Ripley of this. Where
yes, that is a great statement.
Yeah, they're kind of going that direction where you don't expect him to be the last one.
He's the side character. He's the charming, cool guy that's on the side, but he's not the hero.
Yeah, exactly.
But he is the hero, because he's a cool guy. He's such a cool guy that nothing bothers him.
Yeah, he's able to keep his mind straight and over everything. That's why he survives.
Yeah, and I dig that, actually. Like, I think that's actually a really smart decision.
And I would say, like, this film had... This is, like... Again, this is pre-Nightmare on Elm Street. And
yeah.
These deaths are very unique and very creative.
Yes.
And how they're handled. I'm trying to think if I've seen other films predating this that kind of dealt with this kind of stuff of, like, your fears killing you and, like, in this horror sense. Like, I'm not sure if there's anything else before Nightmare on Elm Street. At least that immediately comes to mind.
Nothing comes to mind, but
I won't say blanket statement.
Yeah.
But... Just, I mean, this film I was always talked about on a podcast over one particular scene, which is why I always wanted to check it out. This film is much greater than the one particular scene, but that one scene is just as horrifying and also interesting, like just intriguing. That's the one I want to use. One of the characters, I believe it was not Demaya. There's so many different people.
Was it the nude scene?
Well, yes.
Yeah, that's Demaya.
Yeah, Demaya.
Okay, before basically, you get into it, because clearly you have way more knowledge about this than I do.
Sure.
But when I saw that, the only note that I wrote was, this nude scene is really weird and out of place, and uncomfortable, but not in a way that I'm supposed to feel, in terms of a horror movie. This is just weird, and I didn't like it, and it didn't need to be there.
I was gonna say, I like most of the scene. Okay, so Demaya... Her thing is that she has a phobia of worms. She can't stand worms or anything. So her fear becomes a giant maggot essentially rapes her to death.
Sweet.
Like a giant, like rubber, gooey, disgusting fucking maggot. Not, it's like just laying on top of her, like all its tentacles going all over, like, I guess like appendages really wrapping around her and just like fucking her to death. And but the thing is, during this, her clothes are like just melting off.
Melting.
Like, not hurting her, just like going away to where you have this like Taff O'Connell just writhing around with goo, kind of an orgasmic state. It's so strange.
It's so fucking strange.
Because like the camera is like kind of treating it like it's supposed to be titillating.
Mm-hmm.
Like her tits are out, her legs are converging. So you're not, like,
yeah, there are some weird shots that like made it look very sexy.
It's so strange.
According to the wiki, apparently, like, because I'm reading this now as you talk, mm-hmm. is that this was,
oh,
like...
Yeah. There's an article on it. Okay, wow.
It's so changed. Like, apparently Corman promised financial backers that the movie would have a sex scene with this actress.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an idea of a maggot stripping and consuming her while topless, but since he made that promise, he just combined both ideas. Because of course you do! Don't put any more thought into that, and it was supposed to be forced sexual arouser... raping her and giving her an orgasm so strong that it kills her. Because she's afraid... he stated that his character rewrite idea was that she had a fear of sex and worms, so that was combined in one thing. But O'Connell said in a separate interview that she interpreted it that her character was frightened by her own sexuality and a desire to submit to something more powerful than herself, which the monster was, to a lethal extent. So apparently he just kept editing the scene to make it less fucking rapey, but also less hentai rapey, where you're raped to the point of liking it. Because that's apparently was the original intention of the scene, was that it's supposed to be this horrifying sequence that she ends up being like, oh, this is great. Rape is awesome. So as weird as the cuts are, I feel like now that I'm reading this, those cuts were like necessary to make it not that message.
Yeah, apparently this was way more graphic originally.
I'm glad we're discovering this together.
Yeah, I knew about the scene. I maybe over the time I heard about the original issues of it, but I just remember the scene itself. I was like, let's watch this movie because I want to see this movie because I've heard a lot about it, but I've also heard a lot about the apparently on Wikipedia the quote unquote worm sex scene.
I just wanted to watch this because my other two options were already taken. And I'm afraid that people are not going to like those movies, even though I love them.
Well, we love this film, so at least we're sticking out for some really I think quality B movie material.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, that's the biggest, like, most noteworthy death in the film. Sid Haig isn't in this film a ton, but I think he offers a good performance as a character that clearly has some depth to it, even though it's not portrayed a ton.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I'm interested to know, like, why Live by the Crystals, Die by the Crystals? Is this like some sort of religious thing with him? It's kind of implied that it is.
Yeah, it seems like a religious thing. Yeah,
That's why he has a total faith crises when his like crystal like shurikens were destroyed by the door, and that's ultimately what leads to his death is like fear of a loss or fear of the power of these or something. That's what kills him.
Yeah,
in his fears. I think, and also like man. A great gore scene is when Aluma is being like strangled and like just like ripped apart.
Oh my god! Yeah,
like because her fear is of claustrophobia and being like trapped and entangled and that type of thing. So she's trying to crawl through this space. She's trying to gut it through. Like, yeah, I'm gonna fucking do this. And she for the kind of what you consider like the love interest of the film to be like murdered in this graphic.
Yeah.
The balls in this movie.
Her head fucking explodes.
Right? Like, you're seeing the cords cut so deep, they're, like, severing tendons, like, limbs and
yeah!
stuff.
Yeah! That caught me completely off guard, because it kept going and getting more graphic.
And so much so her head's being compressed and then just explodes in gore. And it was like the fucking, Mondo Burger and, like, Good Burger exploding. Her face went into the grinder, and like those, that was such a noteworthy one. Where I was like, Jesus Christ, wow.
Yeah, I expected that to be like much more simplistic and straightforward, and it kept going.
Yeah, even beyond like when I talk about production design, like the special effects on the gore elements, even like the creature effects. Those alien creatures looked really good.
Yeah,
and again, they're smart. They're kept in the shadows. They're not overexposing them by showing them all the time. They're kept behind people's backs. You see just little tentacles, claws here and there. I mean, legitimately, like, when Balon is trapped in, like, the darkness, and he sees the monster in front of him, and it just, like, fades back into the blackness, that's like, legitimately good horror moments.
Yeah, it totally is.
Like, I thought that was really cool. Captain Trantor is having her whole PTSD freak out and blasting the laser cannons, and goes, like, I think she, like, shoots the airlock, and it fucks her up and, like, explodes, like, nukes her skin. She's, like, just a walking gore fest.
Yeah, 100% that's what happens.
It's crazy. And this is one of those films where, because I think my biggest negatives was the exposition stuff, but like early in the film, it was kind of slow and I was kind of moving along. Okay, I was worried the entire film would be lots of wandering around.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fair bit of that when they're kind of just wandering around, but it's slow, but I think it's deliberate in that regards. Because like when you get to the tail end of like the second act and into the third act, this film is going.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, I'm down for the ride. I've grown to like these characters. Are they gonna survive? What's the mystery of this weird space pyramid that like in some shots I'm like, oh, this is just like foreground or Minnesota. Then they walk close to him, like, no, they built this entire fucking side of this goddamn pyramid. Holy
yeah.
Shit, I mean, I was already impressed by like the giant sections that are like walking up on the outside section of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't say enough about the production design of this movie.
Yeah, production design is top notch.
It's great. So I did have one negative that stood out, was some of the Foley sound effects.
Yeah.
There are some Hanna-Barbera levels of like squishy sounds and like weird alien-y sounds that were just kind of out of place, but they're only a couple scenes. I don't know why they had to use them for those and stuff.
Yeah, that is weird, but whatever.
Yeah, that was a minor thing. Before we get, like, I guess kind of the finale of the film, were there any other negatives throughout that you wanted to talk about?
Not really. Just, okay. I would say a bit of a weak plot, but the themes and the ideas are there.
Yeah, it's a pretty thin plot, but I think the storytelling and just the pacing of the film I thought was pretty good. Like I said, yeah. It's a little slow, but I think it makes great use of its 81 minutes.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it picks up, and things are moving along, and you're just always enamored by the sets, you're always enamored by the creativity of where things are going. So much so that, like, the visuals of the finale of the film, I was down for. I thought it looked great. When you find out that Kor isn't who he said he was, and then you're finding out that Kor is the master,
mm-hmm.
and he's been doing all this to test them, and doing this to pick a new master in Cabrin. And just, like, the whole elements of, like, him having to walk up the steps, and then he's getting to that weird room where the master's sitting in, then, like, all the lights turn from red to blue, and he's, like, addressing all his fears.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, I Edward Albert, man, I thought he was a standout performance in this movie.
Super, yeah.
He was really awesome. Just having to overcome emotions, like, when Aluma is coming back to him, trying to, like, caress him and just trying to kill him. You can see that, like, the hardship on his face of having to kill her, like, again. Like, he already saw her, like, just, like, exploded corpse.
Yeah.
Earlier, and now he's having to actually be the one to kill her and, like, sever all these ties.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty awesome. I was really, really down for it.
I agree.
And completely. Just, even the final stuff between Kor and him, where it's like, you're the master, and so all your rage to kill me has gone. And he still just, like, blows him away.
Yep, still just does it immediately. I love that. I'm glad that it wasn't like a, yep, you're right, I'm not killing you.
Nope. I was so happy they did that.
Yep.
And just, I liked a lot, you know, I liked the kind of the heaviness of it. It's like, you're the master now, you have all these powers. You could just abandon the people on Earth, but they'll just descend to chaos because they need your leadership and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, the core and slash the master put him through so much fucking shit. To test him for this, and now it's just like, okay, well, here you go. You really have no choice in this matter, unless you just want to abandon all of humanity, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's just insane.
Well, not all of humanity. It seems like just that planet.
Because
planet's on the edge of, like, populated space, they said.
There we go. That's more clarifying for sure. That's what I meant by that. Like, just that planet's leadership.
When the master was playing a board game and some commander came on the TV to talk to him, did you get a huge Spaceballs vibes? Because I sure as fuck did.
Yeah, that was that first 15 minutes or so where I'm just like, what is this? I was so unsure what we were in for. Because with that stuff, I'm like, ugh. But then I see the ship, and I see, like, how everything looks. I'm like, okay. You're winning me back over. I'm having faith here. I think this is going to be a good ride. And then I was just constantly impressed by the sets and just everything else going on there.
Yeah.
So yeah, big props out to Bruce D. Clark, and then, of course, James Cameron, for sure, for this film. So any final thoughts for getting star ratings here, Steve?
I think it's pretty cool. I do think that it'd be a bit of a harder sell for people that don't enjoy or see a lot of B-movies. But if you are somewhat familiar with this sort of lower-budget early 80s horror or sci-fi or what have you, I think that this one is pleasantly really good. It really delivers more than I was expecting it to. And also, it's free on Prime, just like A Meowie Christmas and A Meowie Halloween is.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a if you're someone who tries to watch quote unquote, you know, bad movies or B movies that like ironic, like, oh, look how terrible it is. I don't think you're gonna have a good time with this.
No.
I think this film takes its content seriously. It's being made by very creative, caring people who are trying to tell a really good story, and I think are succeeding. I unless you want to sit there and go, oh, that composite shot looks so bad. Oh. Like, what else are you going to really shit on?
Yeah.
What are you going to sit there and try to mock and make fun of? But if you're someone who can appreciate smaller budget filmmaking at this time period and can appreciate the hard work and hard effort going into making everything in this movie look as good as it can, people who clearly care about good performances, even if the script might not be, like, the most in-depth But you can tell these people are giving performances of characters knowing that there's some backstory that they themselves are trying to put into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can have a really good time with this. I for a film I've heard about for a long time, this film did not disappoint. I thought it really delivered.
Yeah.
And so let's get a star rating. Steve, what would you give Galaxy of Terror?
When compared to other 80s B-movie horror, I'd give it a really solid 4 out of 5 because of the character writing, the pacing, and especially the set and production design and the kills. If you're looking at it as like an overall type thing, it may drop a little bit, but only to like a 3.5, because I still think all that stuff is there.
Yeah, for me, it's a case where I'm not sure I'd ever watch this film again. Maybe like 10 years down the line, or if I ever pick up a physical copy, I might pop it in, or I might show it to somebody. Hey, check it out. You might not have seen this film. This might have flown by your radar. That's the case, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. I would still give it a very respectable 4.5. Sorry, 4. 4. I'll get a 4 out of 5. I think 4 out of 5 is, I thought it was really good, and I was just really down for the ride, and I thought, like I said, I will reiterate again the production design, man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sucker for that. I'm also a sucker for good cinematography when you get in there. There's some really good moments in this year, good use of color, which if anybody listens to movie films know I'm a sucker for when you can use color to great effects. So there's that. If you want to get in touch with us, you want to let us know what you thought about this film, or you want to let us know how terrible it fucking was and how we're a bunch of idiots, you can email us at moviefilmsofbillandsteve@gmail.com. You can also find all of our past, future, and present episodes over at moviefilmsofbillandsteve.tumblr.com. We're on iTunes and on Facebook. You know, look us up. You know how Facebook works. Come on, it's 2018. Like us and maybe you'll see stuff. That's just how it works now.
Yeah, maybe.
And on iTunes, subscribe, leave a 5-star review. That'd be really nice of you. And we're also on Stitcher on the website and the mobile app. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at LovableBill.
And folks, if you want to see my films and shit all over them, you head over to SilverSpotlightFilms.com, Facebook.com/SilverSpotlightFilms. Most of my movies are on Prime Video, so if you're a Prime subscriber, you can watch my stuff for free or pay to rent it for a very low amount of money. Karis Hell, you may have heard about that recently, based on how much news there's been. That will be getting its retail release in January of 2019. So if you're into the idea of a killer unicorn, please, please go pick up a copy. I'd really appreciate that. And of course, if you don't know me, I also work for Marvel. I'm officially Spider-Man for all the live appearance shows. So if you want to keep tabs on that, me making children happy, and also just my general cosplay stuff, head over to facebook.com/TheAmazingSpiderSteve. Check out that ass. Or just look me up on Instagram at Dark Mullet.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank 8-Bit Geek yet again for letting us take part in this year's 8-Bit Horror Fest. It was another great time. Please check out all the other episodes of other contributors. They'll be here throughout the rest of this month. And as always, I've been Bill.
I've been Steve.
There's no horror here. We don't create ourselves.